Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bentley, Judge Johnson, Judge Bradfold, the Honorable Elizabeth Graber Bentley presiding.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 17th, 2024. And today's argument is being live streamed, and we're also making an audio recording, which will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. Reminder that there are no other recordings permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. We have four cases on our calendar today, three with oral argument this morning and one for a non-oral conference. And another case was originally scheduled for 10:05, but that was removed from the calendar yesterday. So we will hear the first case and then take a brief recess until 10:40 when the court will proceed with the next case. So with that, Marshall, can you please call the first case on the calendar?
Now calling case number A24-0380, Continental Clay Company Incorporated Respondent versus Foundry LLC Appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, counsel. You'll each be given 15 minutes of oral argument this morning, and appellant then has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. And before you begin your argument, please state your name and the party you represent. You may proceed.
Thank you. My name is David Kirko. I represent the appellant, Foundry LLC. My colleague, Allison Donilek, is also joining me today, and my client is also here today as well. Foundry seeking reversal of the district court summary judgment decision in favor of Continental Clay. Foundry contends that the district court erred in ruling that Foundry's lease violation notice was insufficient, that Continental's equitable defenses of latches, waiver, and equitable estoppel bar Foundry's counterclaims, the ruling that Foundry's supplemental expert report was untimely, and the rulings that the statements of Paul Stewart were inadmissible hearsay and the award of attorney's fees to Continental. All of those issues were in error by the district court and need to be reversed. All of those issues were well briefed. I'm going to focus on the two main issues, which are whether Foundry's lease violation notice was insufficient and whether Foundry's counterclaims are barred by the equitable defenses of latches, waiver, and estoppel.
Mr. Kirko, before you launch into the details, I have a question about those two issues. If we were to rule against you on the second issue, is the first issue relevant?
Yes, they're both. They're both relevant because they both go those the counterclaims. If those are reversed, those claims are still alive, and the breach of contract claim is still there for Continental has, and so yeah, they both do matter.
Well, I guess okay. So the second issue concerns Continental Clay's equitable defenses to Foundry's counterclaims.
Correct.
And the notice of the violation, doesn't that also relate to your counterclaims?
Yeah, it does, in the sense that we have a breach of contract claim, and we are saying that the notice was sufficient, and we're able to proceed and say that they breached the lease by failing to comply and were entitled to eviction and so on.
So if Continental has a valid equitable defense to your counterclaims, then why would the notice of the lease violation matter?
I'm not sure I'm following the question you're
asking. I'll try to say it again. I guess if Continental has a valid defense, one of the three equitable defenses they've identified, which is part of the second issue that you've briefed, why is that not the end of the matter, at least the end of the matter as far as your client's counterclaims are concerned? Why why would we need to consider whether your notice of lease violation was sufficient or proper?
So we wouldn't be able to proceed with our claims against them, but they're still saying that we breached the lease.
Okay, so you're saying the notice of lease violation is relevant to Continental's claim.
To both, yeah.
Okay. But your claims then, I mean, if there is a valid equitable defense, then all of your claims fail?
That's what the district court ruled, and that's what we're here to appeal. But if their defenses applied, which we disagree with, then those would bar the counterclaims. That's the issue on appeal here.
Okay. I'll let you proceed. Thank you.
Thank you. So let's talk about the lease violation notice. And here I want to emphasize that the context in which this arose is critically important. And I just want to go over briefly some of the facts and the context that preceded that, because it's critical to understanding why that notice was sufficient. So remember, the lease that's operative here was entered in December of 2020. That's the active lease. That's the only lease. That's the lease that matters. That's the one that Foundry took assignment of in February of 22. Foundry, shortly after it purchased the property, learns of this prior cracking incident and immediately engages with the prior owner and with Continental to start investigating this to figure out what is going on. Foundry then proposes to Continental that Foundry would hire at its own cost an engineer to take a look at this, to investigate it, and to figure out where Continental could store its pallets of materials and products to alleviate any potential safety concern. And that's something that Continental agreed to.
I appreciate the facts, and I think we've reviewed the record carefully. Just getting back to the breach issue here, what provision of the lease did Continental Clay breach? What provision, or were they in default that caused you to send the notice? What specific provision?
Sure, it's outlined in the lease violation notice, but it's sections 2 and sections 3, which talk about safety and loading the floor.
So the loading is tied to a municipal ordinance rating, right? Or I guess I'm asking to be kind of more specific about what I understand that the notice cites those broad sections, but what was the conduct that breached the lease? At what point, I mean, what amount of loading went from within the provisions of the lease and then exceeded what they were permitted to do under the lease?
Sure. The building as it's built has an as-built safe load limit per square foot, and there's different for the unreinforced areas, and then there's the reinforced areas after the incident. And to be safe, you have to not exceed that limit.
Who sets those limits, or where is the building? Is it a code? Is that any of that in the record?
It's all in the record. So let me address both of those things. So the Minneapolis Building Code, the State Building Code, and the International Building Code, which are all incorporated, that's all outlined in detail in Foundry Summary Judgment Memo, including specific citations. That sets baselines for the safe limits for different types of industrial buildings and so forth. But each building is unique, and so there may be a baseline limit, but it's ultimately, how is this built? This is a building that's 100 years old. And so what the engineers found and what this building we're actually dealing with is that for the original as-built unreinforced areas, that was approximately 180 to 187 pounds per square foot. And then in the reinforced areas, that was a much higher limit because there's steel and so forth, and that was around 566 pounds per square feet. So those are the limits. So there's the code requires that you maintain a safe building and so forth, but ultimately it takes a measure of, well, what is this, how is this building actually built, and what is safe for this building? And so the violation in what Continental violated, and this goes to that context piece, that initial report that Continental received, Foundry received, and was given to Continental was on February 8th, 2022. They were asked, and they had agreed previously, whatever this the engineer says, you will agree to that. The Herzog found, look, the original as-built capacity was at this limit. They asked, reduce this. They refused. The lease violation notice followed 3 days later. The idea that they didn't know what was going on or what the context was is baseless. And so that's why the notice was sufficient. It was a short, plain statement. They knew what was expected of them. They refused to do it. And on the notice, part of the issue is that it doesn't require, and nothing in the lease, and there's no law that says you must explain every single thing about how this must be cured. And in fact, the problem with the district court's analysis, even the district court concluded that, well, the cure logically follows from what they said. I mean, if the cure follows...
Well, I guess that's where... So even taking your point as to whether the notice has to say these are the steps you have to take to cure it, setting that aside, that whether we need that level of detail, but I think the issue is, or maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but how... I at least understand the district court to have thought of it is that you at least have to be specific enough about what the breach was to where that line was in the notice so that they know what the conduct was that they need to stop.
The breach was completely clear and the notice was clear. And it's also the court can take into context when there is a notice the surrounding circumstances, and that's what's here. This did not fall out of the sky on Continental. This followed months of engagement and discussions, and in fact, delivery of a specific report that they were asked to comply. I mean, they knew exactly what it was. The notice provided them a short, clear, plain statement: you're in breach. You're overloading the floor. That's what it is. And look, there's optionality and some discretion in how they could do that. There's a huge space. They've got 32,000 square feet. They could do this in any number of ways. There's a safety concern. But it was completely clear on how they could do it. And the idea that they didn't know what a breach was is unsupported. They might have a dispute about whether they violated or not. That's fine. But the idea that they didn't know or was insufficient is simply unsupported. And also, it would throw into question, I think, common practice of how lease violation notices are conducted. I mean, it's a short, plain statement. Here's what it is. And it's not much more that you have to explain in excruciating, minute detail how everything must be done.
Could you turn to the equitable defenses? I'm curious to hear your argument with respect to, in particular, waiver, or how is it that when the lease was assigned that Foundry didn't step into the shoes of the, is it Cathay Group?
Yes.
And which at least is alleged or argued that they had waived any, issue about the overloading that you've raised here.
Yeah, I'd very much like to talk about that, so thank you. So the answer there is there's a couple pieces to it, but it's straightforward. Remember we talked about there is one lease that's operative that was entered in December 2020. There's no dispute about that. The first page of the lease says the old one was expiring. So what we have here is a one current lease. When we're talking about basic contract assignment principles, you take the assignment of that contract and the rights that are for that contract. What preceded here was 30 years of prior leases that have expired and that aren't relevant here. Claims...
But Cathay entered this lease knowing the practices that Continental was using in the building, right? And is there any evidence in the record that they didn't know about the, any recent overloading or of the floors or something, but I guess I don't see how the 2020 lease is different from the earlier one if the same landlord had entered into it knowing full well what was happening there.
It's different because we're talking about some basic foundational contract principles here, that claims and defenses for a prior contract relate to that contract. And also, all the conduct that Continental and the district court were talking about to rely on was all in relation to the 2011 cracking incident. Okay. And so all of those issues relate to that contract. So if they had a claim relating to that or a defenses, it was under that. And also, to your point about the conduct, there's nothing that's cited by anyone here that says you can impute the conduct from a prior lease or a prior conduct and impute it onto a later assignee of a contract that hasn't even been entered yet. And that's the confusion. Then that's the issue here and why there's a misapplication of the law and a too broad and an overly expansive application of assignment principles that would say, instead of just limiting it, yes, you take the assignment of these rights and what you can do under this contract, Foundry can step into the shoes and they are the landlord and they can force that. But there's nothing that says, and those are the rights, but there's nothing that says the conduct of some landlord from prior leases, six leases ago, is now wrapped up onto this current landlord or this assignee of it. And the problem with that is actually quite frightening. I mean, the risk that that poses for the commercial real estate industry and the market, it's enormous, right? I mean, all of a sudden, if you have a situation where a buyer of property is now subject to anything that happened under prior leases and a prior conduct of a landlord, that's an impossible diligence task. It would have a freezing, chilling effect on the ability of anybody to acquire a property, purchase it, and take that risk and improve it and keep it moving on. That's far beyond what the basic assignment principles allow, and that's why the court erred.
Well, the assignment case law says that the assignee basically assumes all of the rights that the assignor had. So, I mean, how do you avoid, I don't understand what case law you have that avoids that, the operation of that basic rule?
What that was coming from is a overly broad interpretation and I think a misinterpretation of those cases in particular. That's the Glass Service case, the Delisi Investments cases that the district court relied on. That's talking about the rights under that contract. Those cases didn't talk at all about any equitable defenses or anything of that nature. That's beyond that. And there's nothing that says those conduct and the conduct is imputed. We're talking about the rights that come along with under that contract. That's the distinction, and that's where the district court got this wrong.
What about the equitable estoppel defense? What's your argument against that?
It's in line with the same as latches and waiver. First of all, it's quite a stunning decision that all of those, which are conduct-based defenses, has nothing to do with Foundry. These are all defenses based solely on the conduct of another party, and there's nothing that links that. So as to estoppel in particular, to your question, there's nothing in the record here that would say what did Continental do that relied on Foundry that's prejudicial. That is the analysis that it should be, is under this current lease.
Thank you. Your time has expired. You can
thank you.
Come back up for rebuttal.
Yes.
Counsel for respondent. Again, please state your name and the party you represent for the record.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. Chris Olson for the respondent, Continental Clay. I wanted to follow up on a couple issues that I think that Your Honors have identified here that are crucial to this case. Judge Bentley asked about what provision of the lease was violated. And in that context, Judge Bentley, you also asked about did the default notice cite to that specific provision in ordinance? And I think that is crucial to this case. Beyond the equitable defenses, even if you get beyond that, when you get to the issue of the lease, in order to have a default of the lease, you have to have a violation of the provision, of course. If you look at the lease at appellant's addendum, page 22, paragraph 3, what it says, there's a specific provision on the loading of the floors. And what it says is that Continental will not load floors with machinery or goods beyond the floor load rating prescribed by applicable municipal ordinances. Your Honors, here we are, over 2 years later into this litigation, 2 years after that default notice was sent. There's been no citation in the default notice, in discovery, in motion practice, or here in front of this court as to any municipal ordinance that was violated by Continental Clay's loading of
so
the floor.
So what's your response then to the citation to building codes and other safety rules or laws that buildings typically have to comply with?
I'm not aware of any citation in the record at any level of this proceeding to any specific provision that would limit Continental Clay's loading of the floors. As we pointed out to the district court, the building code generally applies to new buildings, not existing buildings. It's irrelevant to that analysis. But beyond that, there is no specific provision that I'm aware of in the record before this court of any municipal ordinance at the city level, county level, or state level, which limits Continental Clay's loading of the floor and was
and
violated.
Then what about the provision about maintaining safe conditions? And is the evidence or the reports that they provided sufficient under the lease to establish some kind of unsafe condition?
I'd point out a couple of things. First, you referenced that provision that comes a little bit earlier in the lease. That's in paragraph 2 of the lease, and it uses the word safe. Kind of generally what it says is that you have to maintain the premises in a clean, safe, sanitary, and first-class condition. I don't think that's talking about the floors, but just assume for a second that it is. And I don't think it's talking about the floors is because paragraph 3 has a specific provision for the floors. But beyond that provision also makes reference, if you read further in that provision, in compliance with all applicable codes, ordinances, rules, and regulations, that's what it's talking about, is you got to follow the law, you got to follow the ordinances, you got to follow the rules and regulations. Again, over 2 years later, there is no rule, regulation, or ordinance that's been cited in the record that's in violation. So, Your Honor, even if we're talking about that.
If I could, when I read the appellant's brief, they're relying, and I heard it in the argument as well, they're relying pretty heavily on this Herzog report that was submitted, I believe, to your client, what, 3 or 4 days, something like that, before the notice of default?
I believe
so
I did hear reference to that.
If we read the report together with the notice of default, do we have enough information to give you notice of your client's default?
No. And the reason
Why
being,
not? Yeah.
The reason being is that you can't, the parties specifically contracted for what could be a breach of the lease. And we just talked about the provisions, Your Honor. Paragraph.
What's missing in the Herzog report? That's what I want.
The Herzog report has no reference to a municipal ordinance that's violated.
Well, so the section 3, let's see, section 2 doesn't only refer to ordinances, as I see, section 3 does. Section 2 refers to laws, codes, ordinances, rules, and regulations without much specificity.
You are right. It has a little more expansive use of words of
right. So has the Herzog report added to that enough to give you notice of your default?
No, because the Herzog report, an opinion of an engineer, is not a law, code, ordinance, rule, or regulation.
No, I understand that, but I mean there was I don't know how you would characterize it, but the appellants are characterizing it as notice given to Continental to reduce its load to 180 PSF. So is that sufficient based on the overall analysis? And
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The notice specifically gave no detail. It did not say, and we want you to reduce your levels to what the Herzog notice says. As I set forth, I don't think the Herzog notice is the proper measure or of determining whether or not there's been a default, but even assuming that it was for the purposes of this question, there's no reference in the notice of default.
So you're telling me that the Herzog report doesn't rely on any standards of any sort, engineering standards or something?
I'm certainly not an engineer. I'm sure the engineer who wrote that report does rely on certain standards of professional engineering. But what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the notice of default itself, it makes no reference by incorporation or otherwise to that report. It also doesn't tell my client that we want you to reduce the load on the floors to a certain level. It's not mentioned at all.
In the default notice?
Correct.
There's no mention. But the Herzog report does tell you?
Correct. The Herzog report does make some reference to certain levels of loading.
Okay. And so just entertain the thought for a second, just for my benefit. What if we read the Herzog report together with the notice of default? And then the Herzog report does tell Continental to reduce the load to a specific rating. Is that enough under the lease to give you notice of default?
I don't believe so. And I don't believe so because of the language that's applicable in the loading, the language that controls, which is in paragraph 3. And so the language that controls in paragraph 3 requires there to be a violation of a municipal ordinance. Because there wasn't, our position is that the default notice, even if it...
So I'd have to agree with you that Section 2 doesn't apply to four floors. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor?
So, because Section 2, like we talked about, Section 2 is broader than Section 3, right? It includes keeping and maintaining premises as in accordance with laws, codes, ordinances, rules, and regulations. So that's broader.
Correct.
Right? Okay. And so you're saying that Section 2 just doesn't apply to floors?
I don't believe so, because I believe the parties contracted specifically in paragraph 3 for a provision that does apply to floors.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson, this first issue about the notice, do you agree with your opposing counsel it's not relevant to Foundry's counterclaims, it's relevant only to your claims?
No, I don't agree with that.
Let me restate, I guess. If we were to affirm with respect to the equitable defenses, your equitable defenses to Foundry's counterclaims, then what would be the relevance of the notice issue? That's the first issue raised by appellants.
The relevance of the notice issue is what dictated this litigation's commencement in the first place, Judge Johnson.
Which claim or counterclaim is it relevant to?
The declaratory judgment count that was pled originally in the first complaint.
Which got dismissed.
Which the court set aside based on its analysis, because it ruled instead under the breach of contract analysis.
So I see that on page 13. District Court concluded in part 3 of its memo that Foundry breached its lease. So it appeared to grant summary judgment to you on your second claim, the breach of contract claim. Is that what the district court did?
That is the way I read it.
But I don't think you moved for summary judgment on your own claims, did you?
We moved for summary judgment on all of our claims, Your Honor.
I mean, I looked at how many motions did you file?
One motion.
Yeah, I mean, the motion appears to be addressed solely to Foundry's claims, trying to defend against Foundry's counterclaims. I do not see any motion document or argument where you're seeking summary judgment on your own claims.
It's the nature of our claims that were pled related to the what we viewed as the breach of contract that had been initiated by the landlord by sending the notice of default. And so when we pled the declaratory judgment, which sought relief from the court in the form of a declaratory judgment that their action was an insufficient notice and therefore a breach of the contract.
I understand the pleadings.
Yeah. And so...
But the motion...
When we brought the motion, Judge Johnson, to dismiss all their claims, if the court reaches the conclusion that all their claims are dismissed in part either because of the equitable defenses or because of the deficient notice, then the court logically must rule for our client as a result of that.
Sua sponte? I mean, do we treat that as a sua sponte summary judgment?
I don't know that I would categorize it that way. I will say that it was the way that the motion, in my view, was litigated before the district court was on a motion for summary judgment in which we asked the court to dismiss all of Foundry's claims and rule in our client's favor on our claims. If I don't have the notice of motion in front of me, if the court disagrees with that analysis, I'll...
So then what remedy did the district court award to you for Foundry's breach?
The district court, of course, dismissed their claims and then awarded us as the prevailing party attorney's fees that were incurred in defending against those claims.
And am I correct, the district court did not award you damages?
Correct. Well, except for attorney's fees damages.
And So is that the sole basis of the attorney's fee award? In other words, if you had been prevailing or successful in defending against the counterclaims, is that a basis for attorney fees or no?
Yes, that is a basis for attorney's fees. The lease says that the prevailing party in any litigation gets attorney's fees.
Okay. Now I have a question about the district court's conclusion that Foundry breached. The district court said, thus, Foundry breached the lease by bringing its suit against Continental, I think that means the counterclaims, right, without having first provided sufficient notice of an alleged breach. If somebody brings a breach of contract claim that's without merit, why that's not simply just a failed claim, why that is in itself a breach of the contract? I mean, is there some provision in the contract that says, you know, parties may not bring unmeritorious claims or anything like that?
I read that line in the order too, Judge Johnson, and I don't think that the court actually was referring to those claims. I think what the court was referring to was the eviction action that was commenced by the landlord. In this case, the landlord, after I commenced the declaratory judgment action, brought an eviction action when the time to cure under the default notice expired.
A separate action or the third count of the counterclaim?
A separate action. My client then moved to stay those claims and combine the cases. The court stayed the eviction claim in the separate eviction and combined the eviction action with this case. Then Foundry amended its claims to include an eviction claim at that point in front of the district court in one pleading.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like just to spend my remaining time talking about the equitable defenses, because I don't think I've really touched on those. And, Your Honors, if there's a case that screams for latches, waiver, estoppel to bar these sorts of claims, it's this case. As you know from reading the facts of this case, my client leased this premises for over 30 years by the time Foundry came along and purchased the property as is, where is, and took an assignment of the lease. I believe it was Judge Johnson that asked my opposing counsel about something about the assignment of the lease and the effect of that. And the effect of that assignment of lease is actually important. Foundry can take no more or no less than Cathay had at the time it gave the assignment. That means, to the extent that Cathay was estopped, or latches or waiver prevented the claims, that Foundry cannot then, by taking an assignment of the lease, revive those claims and bring them anew. At the moment that the claims went away for Cathay, they're gone forever for any landlord that would ever take an assignment, because they'd only step into the exact shoes that Cathay had. Of course, if the rule was different, it would lead to quite absurd results. If a landlord could assign its lease to another entity in order to revive long since expired or stopped claims, then landlords could set up new entities to take assignments to revive claims. Of course, that can't be the rule. The equitable defenses apply the same to Cathay as they do to Foundry. And because of the course of dealing here and the duration of time and even the affirmative acts of the prior landlord, the equitable defenses prevent the claims here. And that's why we're asking this court to affirm the lower court's ruling and grant of summary judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I just want to run through a number of points, actually, that we just heard and respond to that. First, let's start with the building codes. I'm looking at our Foundry summary judgment motion, and I'd go to page 25 and the numerous pages following that provide detailed citations and an overlay of the applicable building codes, how that relates here. The idea that there's no citation and this idea of a fictional ordinance is frankly nonsense. Also, I want to talk about the section two.
But that was in litigation, right? I mean, Were those same ordinances provided before the case was sued out?
Well, the ordinances were not provided before the case was sued out, but that's not necessary. I mean, what's going on here is that Continental and the district court...
I don't want to slow you down. If you want to proceed, that's fine with me.
Yeah. I mean, are taking an overly technical view of the what's required for a notice. The notice provides a simple, short, plain statement of what it is. You don't need to prove the violation. They were on notice of what it was. And if anything else, there's at least fact issues about whether or not this was sufficient in terms of the notice that was provided. On this discussion about Section 2 and 3, I mean, I also completely disagree that Section 3 is somehow controlling over Section 2. The whole lease has to be read and given effect. And the idea that Section 2 doesn't apply to floors makes no sense. Remember, the safety concern here was a much broader, larger safety risk, which is the entire building potentially collapsing. There's a safe condition, and it has to be read with some flexibility that it could be something beyond the floors, and it's so I don't buy that idea at all, and I think it's completely unsupported.
The lease provides that, you know, major structural improvements or repairs are within the responsibility of the landlord, right? So, I mean, it's not to say if there were some major structural problems the floors were breaking through, doesn't it really come down to which party is responsible for addressing that?
Yeah, and those situations, the building has a as-is set limit for what it can withstand. And if the tenant is negligent or reckless in causing something, they are responsible for that. They're obligated. This is standard basic lease provisions. You have to maintain the premises in a safe condition. It doesn't mean you can do whatever you want in the building. That's just simply not how it works, and that's not what the lease says. I want to talk too about some of these ideas here of, well, we can completely disregard anything that was going on now. All that really matters is the conduct of Cathay before, and that also apply here. The problem with all of that is, again, running up against basic contractual principles, is that it would render meaningless provisions in this lease. I mean, Continental negotiated and agreed to this lease. If they wanted something that says I can stack up 9 things high or do whatever in there, they could have negotiated for that. But the idea that all of this conduct then essentially handcuffs a current landlord from relying on just the plain language of the lease to enforce a safety condition is a dangerous and frightening idea. Also, I want to touch on Judge Johnson had some questions about whether this was a sua sponte motion and whether they moved. Continental did not move for summary judgment on its breach of contract claim. I'm looking at the very first line of Continental's memo of law. Continental Clay Company brings this motion for summary judgment to dismiss Foundry's counterclaims for breach of contract, negligence, and eviction, period.
But you haven't argued that district court erred by going beyond the motion.
The issue came up today. I'm answering the question and pointing it out.
Thank you.
The issue still remains if the court made an error of law that needs to be addressed and reversed. But I wanted to at least answer that point on the question.
Relevant to that, I was going to ask you about the first issue in your brief. I guess I'm wondering what appellate relief are you asking for on that issue? If we agreed with you on that first issue, what would the remedy be?
The remedy be would that the on the lease violation notice?
Right.
Yeah. It would be that it's reversed, it's remanded for further proceedings, and the case proceeds to trial on the breach of contract claim.
On Continental's breach of contract
claim. Yeah, on that. Only. That's the lease violation notice issue was in relation to there.
But how does that benefit you? What's at stake? I mean, if the district court didn't award any damages, then why do you want to get that reversed and remanded and go back to trial?
It's because it's part of the basis on which they've determined that they're the prevailing party and have won attorney's fees.
That was my next question. So in your view, Continental's entitled to attorney's fees only if it prevails on its own claim, but not if it prevails in defending against your claims?
They have to be the prevailing party in the litigation. If they're somehow less than that or some piecemeal thing, they are not the prevailing party. If there are issues that remain to be litigated that are unresolved, they're not the prevailing party, and they're not entitled to their attorney's fees.
Well, what if they've successfully defended against your counterclaims, but then there's still issues remaining about...
They've not prevailed.
And the district court, did the district court analyze that issue and reach any conclusions on that?
The district court simply concluded, as I understand it, that they prevailed because the summary judgment decisions effectively left nothing left to decide. Yeah. That the declaratory action they didn't get to, and so they determined, well, they're the prevailing party on all the counts, dismissing the counterclaims and on the breach of contract claim. So that was the attorney's fee.
And I think what we're talking about now is part 5A of your brief at 36, where you say Continental is not entitled to fees if the district court's SJ order is reversed, but it depends on which. Okay, I think I understand.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for both parties. The case has been submitted. We'll issue an opinion within the time prescribed by statute. The court will take a brief recess and reconvene again at 10:40.
All rise.